Thomson Reuters Legal Ed Center and Celesc welcome you to this audio program. To embed or not embed? That is the question. Use the participation tab at the bottom of your screen to send a question to the presenters. Program materials can be found under your supplements tab. It's my pleasure now to introduce our speakers. Shalene Patel and Michael Haas. I'll turn the floor over to them now for further introductions.
Thank you very much. This is Mike Hobbs. We're honored to have this opportunity to speak today on this topic, which we think is interesting, cutting edge, and was really going to help determine some significant issues going forward, most particularly with regard to social media and the internet, but it also has the potential for other areas as well. So with that, my name is Michael Hobbs. My practice is focused exclusively on intellectual property law. I divide my time between litigation and client counseling in the fields of trademark, copyright, false advertising, and unfair competition law. My practice is based in the Atlanta office, but I have clients that I deal with around the country and around the world, and I'm a partner there at Troutman Pepper. Shalene, give some background about yourself.
My name is Shalene Patel. I'm an associate in Troutman's Atlanta office. I've recently just transferred from Pepper Hamilton's legacy Austin office. I work primarily in IP. I do a little bit of work on the side, but I focus mostly on IP litigation, and I'm a frequent author on current copyright disputes, patent and trademark office changes in examination, and trademark examination. And with that, I think we're ready to begin.
Absolutely. Thanks, Shalene. And a couple of just quick housekeeping matters. First is just for those of you who are listening, and you may recognize and say, wait, Troutman Pepper. During the prior to the pandemic, both the Troutman Sanders legacy firm and the Pepper Hamilton legacy firm, both of which had existed in their previous forms for about 100 years, merged as of July 1st, 2020. So if you're emerging from your COVID cocoon and you're wondering, wait, what did I miss? In July 1st, our respective firms merged. We're very excited to now have a firm of approximately 1,200 attorneys in 23 different offices. And this particular presentation is an outgrowth of that, as both of us were from different sides of the legacy firm. So we're very excited about the opportunities and wanted to give you a quick background in terms of that. In terms of a couple other quick housekeeping matters, as was mentioned earlier, this is supposed to be an interactive presentation. And if Shalene and I are just speaking, we hope that it's informative and something that you get benefit out of. But at the same point in time, if you have questions, it really is a chance to answer and address those questions. And so we'd really encourage them, you to submit them so that we can address them. And again, as usual, if you have a question, you're probably not alone in terms of it. And so we'd welcome the opportunity to address it. I know in this format, from what I've seen also with Zoom calls, there's a certain general reluctance to raise your at least figurative hand to ask questions. But again, I would encourage it. This is an area of law that has some nuances and questions. And again, if you have questions, I'm sure someone else who's listening to this also has a question. The other just housekeeping matter is that halfway through the presentation for New York CLE, we will be reading a code to allow you to get CLE with the New York CLE administration. So with that, we'd like to move forward. So first of all, just to give a brief and I guess actually let me give one last procedural is I think as everyone knows and was mentioned at the start of this, the program materials are attached to this particular presentation. We'll not be showing slides during the course of the presentation. So I'd strongly encourage you to, if you have another screen, to go ahead and open that up if you had the opportunity to print them. Shalene and I are going to be referring to the pages from the materials and associated with the presentation, and we hope and we think that they'll really definitely help illustrate that the points we're going to make. So just if you're looking for the slides to appear here, that's not going to happen. But if you have them in front of you, again, we'll be referring to that. So with that, if you and I'll start by example, if you look at page 2 of the materials, you see overall the topics that we're going to go over in discuss that we're going to start with a discussion about what is embedding, that it's fairly important to understand what exactly we're talking about. And I know for a certain number of the people who are listening to this, this is going to be something that you're already very familiar with. For other people listening in, this may be something that we need to just make sure we're all on the same pages, which is why we think it's important to understand it, because otherwise it's going to be difficult to understand the nuances of the decisions. Then also, by way of background, we're going to have a discussion just in, so that everyone's on board and understands indirect copyright infringement as well as direct copyright infringement. Again, got to understand the lay of the land to understand the causes of action, the decisions here. Then recent legal developments on embedding law, some potential defenses, most particularly fair use with regard to the claims that are arising now with these most recent claims. And then some practical recommendations as to what you can do depending upon who your clients are. And if you're like many people in the area, you may particularly have content owners as well as content users, and give some thoughts and ideas as to that. So with that, Shalene, can you give the folks a little bit of an understanding about what are we talking about when we're discussing embedding?
So what we're going to look at is what embedding actually is from a legal definition that courts have provided and some tech and legal sources. What does it look like? Some applications. And after we kind of go through what embedding is, we should have a better picture of why we actually care as attorneys and house counsel, which is someone who wants to be educated as far as what's going on, considering how liability can attach for this. So if we look at page 4 or slide 4, however you want to call it, we see some definitions that are sprouted out at the Southern District of New York. Specifically, when we look at the Goldman v. Breitbart case, that's a case that we'll talk about a little bit more in depth later. And the court there notes that embedding an image on a website is the act of a coder intentionally adding a specific embed code to the HTML instructions that incorporates an image hosted on a third-party server onto a web page. An embedded image will then hyperlink to the third-party website. Because most of this presentation focuses on social media as a content host on a third-party server, think Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, it's appropriate now to mention that anyone who's used a MySpace page is likely familiar with what HTML code is. HTML is it's the language that your browser is using to interpret a web page. Most, if not all, web pages are using HTML. And so the Southern District of New York, in another case we're going to look at later, has basically noted that as a result of embed code, the image appears on the new page, but links remains hosted on a third-party website. So the main takeaway here is that embedding is showing without actually hosting content. And that content can be just about anything from videos, images, GIFs or GIFs, a tweet, or really anything that you can find on social media especially. And if we go to slides 5 and 6, we can start to see some examples of what embedding looks like in different contexts. The first example that we have is from a website called Bleacher Report. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Bleacher Report, it's a website that reports on just about every sport you can think of and commonly uses embedding in its articles. So in this particular example, we have during the NFL season, running back Derrick Henry had just passed the 2,000-yard mark for rushing yards in a season, making him the second Tennessee Titan to join the 2,000-yard club after Chris Johnson did in, I want to say, 2009. So what Bleacher Report did to report on this is instead of writing a full-on article, they made some pros in the beginning to try to introduce the article and then embedded tweets from other athletes or other people who had 2,000-yard seasons to show their reactions. So what we see on the Bleacher Report website is Barry Sanders' tweet embedded onto the website, creating a relatively seamless transition from the article to the embedded content, all without having to go to Twitter to see the original tweet. But if you were to go to the article and click the tweet, it would send you straight to Twitter's website and pull up this exact tweet from Barry Sanders. And that would work for any of the tweets that are in the post. The second example comes from Instax Fujifilm. Instax is an instant film variation that I've personally seen that's starting to rise in popularity among people who want to create instant memories. Think Polaroid picture. It's very similar in concept. In fact, on my desk at home, I have two Instax cutouts that a friend gave me from something,
wondering, wait, what did I miss?
And we were allowed to still see people again. So what they've done here is they've used pictures from their own Instagram page and embedded them right onto their website as a gallery. So if you were to click any of those pictures in that gallery, it would take you to the specific Instagram post where you can see the comments, the captions, any hashtags that were used. And what I want to emphasize is that while all the pictures here are from InstaX's page, they could have just as easily embedded a picture.
Now have a firm of approximately 12.
Your public page, a famous athlete's page. The functionality is pretty seamless. And, you know, it's not just specific to images or tweets. Google actually does a good job of explaining how to embed a video. If we look at slide 6, we can see Google actually gives a demonstration on how to embed a YouTube video in another page. Google has what's called an application programming interface, or an API, that allows embedding functionality. And with embedding in an API, the idea is to have a website server talk directly to Google server with a request to watch the video. So when we see this in practice in the second example on slide 6, we see what happens when YouTube, a video is embedded from YouTube. You navigate to a video that you want to embed that has embedding permissions. YouTube allows users to block embedding privileges. So in this case, we're looking at...
In terms of a couple other quick house
video with an embedding option, NBC hosts some of their clips directly to YouTube, and you can embed that clip even at a certain starting point into another website. The result of using this embed code in the example on slide 6 allows another user to play the video hosted entirely on YouTube without them actually navigating to YouTube.com. So in the InstaX case, we could look at InstaX's homepage, and if they chose to embed a YouTube video, you could watch this video without them ever hosting it.
Interactive presentation and
YouTube.com. The website's embedded the YouTube video.
If Shalene and I are just speaking,
embedded tweets. And the important thing here is to kind of realize that while I may have taken a picture of the screenshot of what an embedding situation looks like or what code shows up, the difference between taking a picture and embedding is that one creates a copy. That is, I created a copy of this video still showing the embed frame. And the embed frame is then something that I pasted into my presentation. So this isn't...
It really is a chance to
answer. If you were to embed this content, it would be able to be played, and there is no local host on that third-party website.
Answer and address those questions, and so we'd really...
YouTube. So how is it different than hyperlinking? If you look at page 7, I put some of the differences, but simply the difference is really in what I'm going to refer to as options. Well, what do I mean by that? So if we look at slide 7, an embed actually displays the underlying content where the user sees the embedded content as if it was part of the page. So if we look at this example from an ESPN article, this is an article about a tweet and a subsequent apology by Nick Saban's daughter. Nick Saban,
if you have a question, you're probably
recent national champions. And his daughter had shared some thoughts on Ohio State's reported COVID cases that may have
alone in terms of it and
even changed when the date of the national championship was going to be, leading up to the college football championship.
And so we'd welcome the
fan out there. They may remember that Cardale Jones, the third string backup from Ohio State, actually beat Alabama in a national championship in 2015.
So address it. I know in this format,
ESPN comments on Cardale Jones's tweet where he references Kristen Saban Seatos's.
I've seen also with Zoom calls.
So since the most downstream tweet being Kristen Saban's tweet is now deleted, what's actually
a certain general reluctance
to embedding, but just one. Cardale Jones in his tweet has actually saved that picture and added it as an attachment to his tweet, and then ESPN is embedding that whole image. So what is framed essentially in ESPN's article, that whole image is embedded as if it's one thing. So if you were to click that image, you would be able to see the tweet with the embedded picture, but then if you try to go one step further and to find the original tweet, you wouldn't be able to find it because that's not embedded, that's actually saved as a picture or another copy. So when we look at that from a standpoint
question, again, I would encourage it.
When you embed content, you're forcing the user to look at that option. As soon as that embed is there, you're looking at that page. But when you have a hyperlink, you're directing a user to a web page. So in this case, if you want to look at something in a hyperlink, you can't actually see what the underlying content is until you go to where the hyperlink takes you. So as a shameless plug for those of you on your computer, you can look to your hyperlink. You can look at the hyperlink on page 7 and read my article on copyright. And we have gotten some questions about, is there a problem with the broadcasting? We are aware that there's some technical difficulties on the hosting end. So I believe that we are still good to go, but there's nothing we can do right now, and there is a problem with the stream quality. So to recap the options difference is that with an embed, there's not really an option.
That halfway through the presentation.
What is embedded? As soon as I go to a random page that has something embedded from Instagram, I'm going to see that post, whether or not I click on it or not. But if I was to create a hyperlink, I then give the option. So the real question is, now that we have a general idea of what embedding is, how does it translate to the user's interface? Why do we care? Why is it that we
allow you to get CLE with
embed when we have the option to just avoid the practice altogether to make sure that we 100% have no issues and we only post content that we don't? Well, there's a lot of practical applications to embedding beyond the social media context and beyond just simply showing something that you've seen to someone else. On slides 8 and 9, we've gone ahead and articulated some of those reasons.
So with that,
first of which is substantive commentary on embedded tweet. As we just saw with that ESPN article, there was an entire article dedicated to a tweet and a response to that tweet. So from a journalistic perspective, we're going to see more cases in this presentation alone about why we care about using or someone's use of embedding content as an actual vehicle for more journalism or substantive commentary. Another reason is we want to promote favorable publicity. Companies get a lot of feedback through social media. Unfortunately, most of it's a complaint on Twitter.
Yes, actually, let me give one last procedural.
Who make a living being called influencers who post on social media very commonly, and they give positive feedback. And embedding is a great way to show that feedback with some credibility, right, as opposed to just putting in a quote in your web
of this. The program material.
Someone's positive experience with the product. And another reason is that you're saving storage space.
Most materials
which is a headache for email and other content. And by not hosting those images or having to rehost, even if you're embedding your own work, that you're not saving a ton of space on bandwidth and server space. And then one more other reason is social media is easy to be integrated. Instead of having one account and having users navigate to a web page, a Twitter.
During the course of the presentation
page, you can now show kind of a seam where you have all three major social media platforms integrated into one, showing all the positive feedback that you could be getting in a different variety of contexts, adding more credibility to a brand or a message or whatever it is that you want to communicate through social media. And then similar to that, you want to expand traffic. That's on slide 9. What we mean by expanding traffic is if you have a video hosted to YouTube and you embed it onto your webpage, well, you not only get the chance to have someone view a video on your webpage, but maybe they check out the YouTube channel. And then they find out that your brand has its own channel with other videos that they want to check out. Well, now you've given them a vehicle to check out both your webpage and other social media that you posted that you might not be embedding. And then I think one of the most important reasons these last two go together are leveraging hosting platforms.
The materials.
Twitter and Facebook have spent a lot of money on developing infrastructure so that we can host and share content. By embedding content rather than hosting it, we're now using Google's resources or Facebook's resources or Twitter's resources to try and load those videos, keep our bandwidth down, and to try and make sure that
we hope and we think that they'll really definitely.
There is enough bandwidth to go around, especially during heavy traffic areas when you think about heavy promotional periods. We've all probably tried at least at some point to go through a promotion and we find out the website's down, or we want to do a promotion and we can't get through because there's too many requests on the server.
So just if you're looking for the
solutions to embedding, And there's a lot of reasons that it's done periodically, or actually, as we're seeing,
slides to appear here, that's not going to happen.
And these practical reasons are going to explain why we're going to look at, well, is embedding infringement? So before we get into the legal arguments, there's just some interesting facts that we found on embedding and the state of embedding right now. On slide 10, we mentioned that nearly one in four articles contains at least some social media embedded content. And of that one in four, almost half come, or more than half, come from Twitter.
With that, if you
are embedding tweets constantly, Twitter has a very easy embed policy, a user face or interface. What happens is you can simply just click on a tweet and there's an option to embed, and you can copy that tweet into a forum.
And page two of the materials.
Into an article. And around the summer of 2020, we found that Instagram actually had changed its policy regarding embedding. We can see here that Instagram's new policy indicate that any user who chooses to embed represents and warrants that they own or have secured the necessary rights to display, distribute, and deliver any content they've embedded elsewhere from Instagram.
We're going to start with a discussion about what
a position that they're now going to try and put the onus on users to ensure that they have the necessary rights before violence
embedding, that it's fairly
IP. So now that we kind of have a general idea of what embedding is, I think it might be a good time to actually get into substantive discussion. So I'll hand it over to Mike to discuss indirect infringement.
Absolutely. Thanks, Shalene. And I think just listening to that, depending on what your personal experience is with social media, I think you're going to have a couple of reactions to what Shalene said. I think that one of them is that if you are above a certain age, and I would lump myself into that, that you're going through and listening and thinking, okay, and particularly if you have an intellectual property background, you're thinking, okay, something that you're already very familiar with, or I'm looking at these Instagram feeds or these Twitter pages and saying, look, that looks like a photograph. I mean, that is the photograph that was taken by someone, or that's the video that was taken by someone. And, you know, if I'm thinking about my copyright infringement, why is that not infringement? And that's something we're going to get into very briefly, if you're of a certain experience with social media where it's all on the same pages, which is why part of your every minute or hourly life. I think the other reaction you're going to have to this is, duh, you know, that, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, this is the experience that I'm used to. And I think that the cases that we're going to go through are going to give a little bit of an explanation as to why that became the norm. There was a path that was out there a number of years ago as to whether this type of embedding was an infringement or not. And if it had not occurred, in the case it had not, in one case in particular, had not come down the way it did, that you'd have a very, very different social media experience. And I think everyone agrees that hyperlinking is certainly okay. But if you're going through and you're looking at an Instagram social media page, and it's a series of links with no images, no video, no other tweets, and it's just links to them, I think everyone would realize and agree that that's just such a different social media experience that would have been unlikely that social media would have exploded the way it has over the last 10 years. So with that preface, I wanted to go, and Shalene and I wanted to both set the table for indirect infringement, just so that we can understand a little bit. We're going to go into direct infringement in just a minute, but indirect infringement is an important copyright infringement as cases, because you have to understand that, you know, direct copyright infringement is if you copy something and you don't have permission to do it, that constitutes infringement. Indirect infringement is if you facilitate the infringement, that you make it, your system, your company, your operation makes it so that you are providing the means by which copyright infringement occurs. Causes of action, the decision. To be clear about it, if there's no infringement, there's no contributory infringement. And that sounds basic, but for example, if I provide a website that allows for hyperlinking, well, hyperlinking is allowed. There's no copyright infringement about that. That's well settled law. So if I'm providing that, well, I can't be liable for contributory copyright infringement. Again, if the underlying act doesn't constitute copyright infringement. But there's been a number of cases, and probably the most relevant one, some potential defenses, most copyright of 1984, which was, if you can picture the videotape and the particularly fair use with tape, program and machine that allowed you to record programs. And you may have seen one in your history books or in your grandparents' house, and it may still be there today. But essentially, the networks and content providers said, hey, look, you know, you are providing a machine that allows individuals to make copies of our programs. That is contributory infringement. And then some practical recommendations, and that's what this machine is for, is to make copies. And by doing that, Sony, you are liable for contributory copyright infringement, and we should stop the manufacture of this machine. Supreme Court looked at it, and some brilliant lawyering by Sony's lawyers, and they came back and said, we're not on who your clients are, and if you're like Google, that if I watch a program at 8 o'clock on ABC, I'm allowed to do that, right? And everyone agrees, yes, you can do that. Well, if I want to watch the program at 9 o'clock because I can't watch it at 8 because I'm putting my kids to bed, or I'm out on a working out in my gym, or I am watching another program, well, and I shift it to 9, that's time shifting. And that's not an infringement. It's just, it's the program is just moving to a different hour. And that's what the Supreme Court agreed with. And so they found there was no contributory infringement. There was a legal means of the use of the product and the device. So no infringement with that. So you then take the other end of the spectrum, which was, for example, and a number of y'all may be familiar with and recall Napster. And so Napster was a program that was on the internet. With that, Shalene, could you give recordings and off your CD or other recordings? You put it in the folks a little bit of an understanding about anyone there could download it, and then they could create their own playlist, their own. What are we talking about when we're discussing embeds? And the Supreme Court examined that one, and they said, hey, look, there's nothing legal about this. The way you have said it.
So what we're
going to use for this. So you're contributing to the infringement. The copy of the recording, which is protected under copyright, is an infringement. And so as a result of that, that you're contributing to it, and they effectively shut Napster down. Napster reconfigured its business model so that it did recreate a legal use. But in some ways, proving the point, Napster pretty much faded away pretty quickly because the legal use people didn't want to use. I mean, that was not the
best. And legal sources.
Keeping in mind these cases, think about, okay, so you have the actual infringer who, or alleged infringer in these copyright cases who's making the copying, but then also are there the different companies that are allowing the,
And after we kind of go through what.
And is that a contributory infringement by the companies that, for example, that allow the embedding? So, with that, Shalene, you want to go ahead and discuss about the case law on direct infringement?
Sure. So, I mean, starting off with direct infringement, there's 6 enumerated rights in copyright that's provided by statute. The first is to reproduce the copyrighted work. The second is the right to prepare derivative works based on the copyrighted work. And the third is to distribute copies of the work by sale or transfer of ownership, rental, or lease. The fourth is specific to audiovisual works, and that's the right to perform as far as what's going on, considering. And the fifth is similar to the fourth, except it's a public display right for the same audiovisual works. And lastly, there's a specific work for right for sound recordings, specifically that there's a public performance right related to digital transmissions. So in the context of embedding, we're mostly interested in displays. So if we look at it, to some extent, we're interested in public performance, but that one we expect will fall in line with the other rights as they start to settle on page 4 or slide 4. So I think it's best to nail down what courts regularly describe as the display right and the reproduction rights, or however you want to call it. We see some definitions. Display right is one, and both the reproduction and distribution rights is kind of another right that they commonly look at together. To keep things simple, let's focus on images. I think it's more appropriate for this kind of context, especially when videos
talking about. And I know for
specifically when we look at the Instagram, where we're starting to find problems with as far as people getting in trouble or getting sued for copyright infringement. So in the Breitbart case, that's a case that will display it right. We're asking ourselves, really the question is embedding an image such that it displays the image to the end user without the potential infringer hosting the image constitute direct infringement? In other words, if I'm showing, and the court there notes that, but I'm not actually showing it to them through me, but rather who actually owns the product, embedding an image on a website for a while, about a decade, that answer was actually no. If I don't own the content and I'm not, is the act of a coder intentionally, or rather I'm just telling you where to get it, that's fine. So in the case of embedding, if you're adding a specific embed code, you're probably safe to embed whatever you wanted. And for the reproduction,
this may be something that we need to just make.
Just what is instructions? How are we actually getting that data to the end user? So the question here is a little bit different, and it asks, does causing an image to be cached, stored in RAM, or stored in some other digital image hosted on a third party constitute a reproduction or a distribution of a work that's unauthorized, if that reproduction technically originated from an author?
I think it's important to understand it, because
directing someone via embed to create a copy in their RAM, but I'm really saying, well, the data is stored here, and that data is an embedded image will then hyperlink. Me as the facilitator, almost a broker of that data, can I be held liable? So it's, I think of an example to the third party website, link posted on Instagram. Say I wanted to embed that image on my website. Because my website uses embed coding, my website's not actually hosted, because most of this presentation focuses on this picture of a link. So I'm technically not distributing anything but code. But by embedding instead of hyperlinking, what I'm forcing you to see is a copy of that picture without the copyright owner having a real say into whether or not, you know, I can show other people his picture. Content posted on a third-party server. And what we're going to find out is, while that answer used to be resounding, yes, that's fine, the law is not so clear anymore. And that the Eastern District
on board and understands indirect.
I think it's the Eastern District of Texas are starting to claw that back a little bit. So how do we get to the initial answers of these being an acceptable practice? We got them from a case called Perfect 10 in the Ninth Circuit in 2007. So if you look at anyone who's used a MySpace page, adult entertainment magazine that featured images of women and also operated a subscription-only website, these would be not safe for work pictures. Other third-party websites had taken Perfect 10's images and hosted them without Perfect 10's authorization. Google had what's called a crawler program that cached and indexed the unauthorized images, resulting in images showing up in Google's image search. While Google didn't host the full-size images, it did host and directly transmit these thumbnails that users use. So anyone who's familiar with Google Images, and we'll go through an example in a moment, you know that when you search something, you're going to find all the thumbnail images and then have be able to find language that your browser
is here. Then recentlegal.com,
Amazon has something called an A9 search engine at work at that time for copyright infringement. And as a result, at the district court level, Google was enjoined from displaying the video thumbnails. So as we go through the rest of these materials, I think it's important to remember that the Ninth Circuit was reviewing this case that was seen to settle law for a while. All web pages are using agents. Appeals court deciding whether or not
some potential defenses.
So to give a more PG example, we go to slide 19, and I have a 2021 Google image search of a Bernese Mountain Dog. Why Bernese?
Particularly fair use with
beautiful dogs, and my household is expected to adopt one actually pretty soon. So obviously Google Images searching has changed a bit since Perfect 10. But what we still see here is close enough. When you search in Google, you initially see what's under the search heading itself. It noted that as a result of embed dogs, and we can click on one of those to get a better idea of how big the full picture is, the quality of the full size picture, where we can find the full size picture. Image appears on the market, we can share it. So let's say we were to click that very first picture at the top. And that's outlined in a red box for anyone who's viewing in color. Once we click that red, the image outlined in red, and we get the image on the right that's outlined in blue. So in this case, we decided the red outline picture was hosted by Google. When Google's
crawlations as to what you can do depending upon
10 pictures. They were able to save the. So if someone was to look for that something that they indexed, you would be able to find that picture, even if it wasn't hosted by that third-party provider anymore. It's similar to the Wayback Machine, where the Wayback Machine is another kind of crawler that crawls the internet. It'll cache a page, heading is showing without actually the Wayback Machine is hosting another version of a page. And then in the blue outline picture, that's something that's going to be considered embedded. So in this case, or in this example, that's going to be from the American Kennel Club. In Perfect 10, you can substitute that with the more risque pictures that Perfect 10 was trying to sell. And that would link to whoever was hosting the picture, because the issue here was that other people were taking those images, base model, hosting it for free somewhere else, and Perfect 10 was trying to sue Google as a facilitator. Obviously, for a website operating on a subscription-based model, seeing these pictures in thumbnail versions and then having access to a full-size picture
as to that. So
subscription was going to hurt their bottom line. And to summarize, the red outline is hosted by Google and blue is an embed. So how did the court resolve whether or not Google...
With that, Shalene, could you give...
Or how did it involve resolve those questions that we were asking on slide 17? So when we started the display right, the court adopted what's commonly known as the server test. That's on slide 20. In deciding whether or not Google violated Perfect 10's display right, the district court reasoned, and the Ninth Circuit then approved, that a computer that stores an image as an electronic information and serves that electronic information directly to a user is displaying that electronic information in violation of copyright holder. So because Google hosted those thumbnails, those were likely to directly infringe. So what we're going to do, we're not hosted by Google, but rather Google was giving you the instructions of, hey, here's the first example that we have from there, those images were not likely to infringe. What I'm going to look at is what embedding action that although consumers may think that the full-size image belonged to Google, the Copyright Act affords no protections stemming from consumer confusion. Those of you who are familiar with trademark law will know that the Lanham Act specifically, for those of you who are unfamiliar, one of the important parts of trademark infringement is confusion. But to the court with the Blazer Report, it's a website that reports, right? Our Congress was aware of confusion as an issue in intellectual property, but chose purposefully to admit it from copyright. So that same reasoning was applied to the distribution right, saying that Google doesn't distribute anything. It just told browsers where to get it. So it's essentially the same thing as asking someone at the store, you know, from the corner, where can I buy X? And they don't sell it to you, but they tell you where to get it. Even if the users were getting the full-size images from what they thought was Google. So that lasted for about 10 years. And then other courts have also started to apply. One out of District of Colorado and Grady v. Iaculo discussed a server test related to reproduction. So in this particular instance, and after we kind of go through what resulted in there being some reproduction to the computer. So essentially here, what the court did in this Colorado case was they brought into the server test and wanted to prove that somewhere there was actual copying of the information, not just providing instructions. In other words, was there a choice? Right? Are you choosing season running back Derrick Henry? Using them to see it. But either way, there's no copy. In a similar picture of why we actually care, it just passed the 2,000-yard mark. It survived a motion to dismiss, but then had to prove that somewhere a copy of the plaintiff's copyright software was distributed by the defendant's website. The case relied on where the copies actually came from, the copyright owner or someone else, and that the consumer, the second Tennessee Titan to join, was of no relevance. But as we're going to see, and Mike's going to get into, is that there's recent developments now that show that the server test might not be as strong as we thought, it might not be as over far-reaching as we thought, and that even the Ninth Circuit might want to take a look and see if this goes only to search engines or more. And with that, I'll hand it over to Mike.
Thanks, Shalene. Excellent. Why don't we take just a quick aside and handle a little bit of housekeeping that for those of you who are seeking CLE
or did to report on this is instead of
as you're aware, you need to provide a program code for the when you're submitting your CLE request. And so if you take a moment and grab a pen or a pencil or whatever it is you use to make a note, we're going to give you a program code for the CLE.
page four or slide four
is anarchy. Actually, I'm kidding with that. It's not anarchy. I wanted to give you one more minute to get a pencil, so or pen. So if you get that, let me give you the actual program code. Please don't submit anarchy, and I hope that was egregious enough that you'd know that that would not be the case for an actual code. The program here is HP, as in the company Hewlett-Packard. HP, no association, but that's what the code is, 3114-1.
Specifically, when we look at the Google, who had 2,000 yards.
Write this down again. I'm going to repeat it. The difficulty is after this, we're not allowed to provide it.
Reasons to show their reactions.
Responsive if you miss this. So again, one more time, HP 311.
So what we see.
12221. I'll read a third time. HP 3114.
Bleacher Report website is.
21. So hopefully everyone's gotten that, and then we can return back to the presentation.
And the court there notes that,
as I said earlier about the what became of it, if you take a, and you think about
it onto the website, creating a relatively
in 2007 with the Perfect 10 case, about that there was a real fork in the road as to what could happen on social media and on the internet, that if the Ninth Circuit had said and
the coder intentionally
believed and agreed with Perfect 10 and said, look, you know, there are these images on the Google site. There are images.
Having to go to Twitter to see the original tweet, adding a specific embed code
or in whatever form. If you go back to what Shalene said about the rights as a copyright owner, one of the rights is display. I get to control the display of my works. And if the and so Google's lawyers did an amazing job about characterizing this. And if you think about, there's some, as I mentioned earlier,
incorporates an image hosted on a third party.
The way the case was framed in that case was, well, it was just time shifting. So
that tweet from Barry Sanders.
They said, look, it's just temporary. It's just, you know, that these, you know, we're linking that these images, yeah, they're on, you know, but it's the result of a search. They're thumbnails and they are, yeah, they're displayed, but they're not on our server.
An embedded image will then hyperlink.
So that's not an infringement. And the Ninth Circuit agreed. And so if you think about it, that crossroads, if you think about the worlds that I described earlier, was if the court decides that's an infringement, that is a display, there, it's not granted, Perfect 10 suing over it, so they clearly didn't.
Instax Fujifilm.
And so at that point, you basically have an internet and social media that's hyperlinking. That's it. It's one series of hyperlinks after another. Instead, basically the whole Google model is allowed to go forward. So if you do a Google image search, I mean, it's a fantastically, you know, useful but also lucrative business for Google. So, and then the model changed also as a result of that. That back
people who want to create instant memories,
people were talking about linking agreements. Oh, you need an agreement in order to, for someone to link to your site. Well, then you had,
I think, Polaroid picture
and enabled to work with Google's algorithms that allow for search engine results and optimization.
It's appropriate now to mention that
how many links are actually linked to a particular site. That became good to link. And so you, if someone came to you and said, hey, I want a linking agreement, people would just stare at you as to it, because it's just not part of the vernacular. Same thing in terms of this, that embedding, as you saw the examples that Shalene said,
Instax cutouts that a friend gave me,
commonplace and expected, as a matter of fact, with social media, that you have embedding and that courts
something
people through that. And what you'll hear in the lawyer's shorthand is, oh, that's okay under Perfect 10. Perfect 10 allows that. Perfect 10, you know, says that's fine. Not on our, it doesn't reside on your servers. That's fine. Perfect 10 allows that. Well, what subsequent has happened to that is that what was pretty much, you know, people again
is it's the
Perfect 10. That's allowed. That as long as it didn't reside on your servers, that was fine. You could display it. You could embed it. You could do whatever you wanted with that. That was just fine. So gradually, though, what you're seeing, though, is and as Shalene said, there's some courts that have adopted it, but subsequent to it, there's some courts that had some real skepticism about
is using to interpret a web page.
And well, that's okay. So if you turn to our slides and you take a look at slide 23, you'll see the slide for Leader Institute versus Jackson. And sometimes it, you know, you hear that bad facts make for at least bad law. I'm not sure in terms of bad law in this particular case, but certainly an examination as to what should be permitted. So in this particular case, you had two leadership groups that performed charitable services for companies. You'd build a bike together. It was team building
and so
charity, and it would build teamwork and responsibility within companies. So you had one of the people who had worked with one of the companies left. And so
specific Instagram post where you can see the comment
but all over the place that if you look at the actual pleadings as to this, there was original claims,
captions, any
bad faith, misappropriation, breach of trade secrets. And then there were counterclaims flowing back for
tags that were used,
competition and copyright infringement. So this particular case for us is relevant because in this case, what Leader did was they took and they got some domain names, okay, that they registered themselves, and then they
the image appears underneath.
Okay, so that they had the and they owned the site, they owned the exterior of what was on the site and
page, but links remains hosted
content, copyright protected content from the defendants in the middle of that. So the plaintiff said, hey, look, this is just the same thing as embedding. This is perfect 10 all over again, that the what we've done with the
your public page, a famous athlete's
on infringement, and then the materials that are the defendants, they're just embedded, that they are
page, the functionality
to them. They go to the defendant's server. You can go there if you want, and that's fine. You know, so that should be allowed under
betting and showing without actually.
The court, though, said, look, take a step back in terms of this. And again, reading into it, some of the behavior in terms of it just
posting content and that content, not just
and registered domain names that tied in with the defendants. They had done this
frame. That can be just about anything from video. Specific to
the works. So going back, as I said earlier about the perfect 10, that you have this whole issue of a display is a right, is a copyright owner. And the court said, look, you know, you're displaying this. And the plaintiff said, yeah. But we don't possess the actual content here. We're just linking to it. And the court said, well, look, here's the analogy. If I walk into a movie, if you
explain how to embed,
actually went into movie theaters and I have a video camera, I have my phone and my iPhone and I'm recording a movie and then I upload it on
a video
onto my site. And so that people can then watch the whole movie as to that. Is that infringement? And the court said, look, you never possessed the
specialty.
And if we, you created a copy of it and you're displaying it and that would constitute a copyright infringement. So the court said, look, the framing theory.
Go to slides 5 and 6. We can start to,
you know, the Ninth Circuit, the fact of possession or non-possession is not anywhere found in the Copyright Act. And we think that this is also fundamentally different from Google's.
See some examples what embedding looks like.
So that also being that, you know, what Google did was you run the search. And
what's called an application programming interface.
If you remember Shalene's example in terms of the
different contexts,
you know, the mountain dogs are show up as the search. I asked for that. I did the image search. This is what I wanted to see. Whereas with this, it's
the first example that we have
immediately there. I didn't run a search
functionality. And,
you know, the particular images, they're shown to me. And that's what happens as a result of that.
Is from a website called Bleacher Report.
Some chinks in the questioning in terms of perfect 10. So if you turn to slide 24, page 24, you see further rejection. This time it's from the Southern District of New York. The previous case with the Leader Institute was Northern District of Texas. Now we've got Southern District of New York, which in the copyright world is a pretty big deal. So now you're starting to have a question. In this particular case, the underlying copyright protected work was there was a photo that a photographer had taken of Tom Brady going out to recruit Kevin Durant to the Celtics.
Well, when we see this in practice, and this,
as you'll recall, ultimately, or if you're a basketball fan, you'll recall, ultimately went to the Warriors. But Brady was trying to recruit him to the Celtics. And so as a result, that was huge news. Kevin Durant is a tremendous basketball player. And so this went all over Twitter, Snapchat, Reddit, blew up the internet. And, the defendants in this case, Nudes, embedded tweets with the pictures showing Tom Brady going out and doing this. So the photographer sued for copyright infringement, and the defendant said, oh, perfect 10.
YouTube videos embedded
this. We don't actually own a copy of the photographs. The photograph is not on our website. All we're doing is, and again, if you recall the examples from earlier, all we're doing is it looks and it's displayed the photo and the tweets that are out with regard to it. But all we're doing is actually making a link and embedding that. We're not actually making a copy. The court took a look at it and they said, hey, look, the server test may have some merit if you're distributing the work, so that if you are directing
permissions. Example we have during the NFL.
Okay. Google is – so I run my Bernese Mountain Dog search. I see different links and then I say, oh, this looks like it. I want to see more. And then I go to the AKC website and I learn more about it. So then the argument is, well, I'm just traffic cop. I am directing and allowing people as the result of search to find access and information so that they can find it and it's available on the internet. In this particular case, though, that this is a direct infringement is the court said, at least on summary judgment, said, look, that with this, you're just
Saturday night live for rushing yards in a season.
So this particular aspect in terms of perfect 10 is, yeah, that if we are looking at the server test and where it resides, that may have some validity for search engines because
the second Tennessee Titan to join
not residing on my servers. It just is temporarily there as a result of this search request. But you have to search, you click on a link and then you go to the site. Whereas here, and if you look specifically on page 25, you see an example of the difference between it. So on the left side that, it's a frame search. I've got the Bernese Mountain Dog.
Johnson did. And I want to say
terms. Here are the results. And then if I want to go and actually take a look further about it, I have to go and I have to click on the link or the picture. And then that takes me to that.
Using this embed code in the example,
there is an actual embedded. There's no clicking. There's no, it's everything that's there on the tweet, everything that's there on the
content. Or did to report on this is instead of
there. And so you have some real skepticism by the court in Goldman rejecting the
to play the video hosted entirely on YouTube.
So what's the
article?
So you're already seeing some real skepticism about, okay,
without them actually navigating,
we're going to potentially allow it. But if it's an article embedded content, we may have some real questions with regard to that. And that's what Goldman took a look at. So you have the factors and the features of a search engine embedded content that it's a thumbnail. Okay. It's not the actual picture. And usually it's a poor resolution quality. Multiple results. It's automated based on the results of my inquiry. And I have to click through and it provides a
key article and then embedded. Tweets
is what I'm doing. I'm directing people. But
at a YouTube video, you can watch this video.
Then again, it looks and it is specifically something that the host has decided to post.
From other athletes or other people who have.
With embedding the media. And there's no choice. I see it, whereas on the search, I can decide whether to link to the photo.
And without them ever actually navigating.
That sets the tenor for where we are today.
When at 2,000 yards.
And it had been everyone, oh, perfect 10. That's perfect 10. That's okay allowed under perfect 10. And now you're starting to see this questioning as to that. So you've got two cases that are at the forefront in terms of the developments right now. The first of them is the McGuckin versus Newsweek case. The second is Sinclair versus Ziff Davis. And both Southern both this year, and there's a real dialogue going on with the courts between these particular cases. So you have initially the Sinclair case was Mashable had a was doing a story on
embedded tweets.
Yes, they found a photo that had been taken by the plaintiff in the particular case. They went to her and asked to license it.
And the important thing here is to kind of
$50 for it. She said, absolutely not. I'm not allowing that. And they ran it anyways. And they came back and they said, and so she sued for that and said, look,
well, I may have taken
my copyright protected work. You ran it in an article. This is what I do. This is what I license my work to do.
In this transition from the article
after you said you're going to run it. So on the first go around on this case, defendants had raised
a screenshot of what an embedding
do this. That if you go to Instagram, by posting the photo, the photographer had granted a right.
Situation looks like or what
photo, including to embed it.
Having to go to Twitter to see the original tweet.
Defendant said, look, we have a sublicense right as to
up.
Language that's there is a potential right to sublicense. And so we have a right and we're okay. And that's that ends the claim. And the court initially said, yes, you're correct. There was a license that Instagram granted to Mashable. And
embedding is that one creates a copy of that article and click the tweet.
McGuckin is a photographer. Newsweek was running an article on
I created a copy of this.
The plaintiff had a picture of a photograph, rather, of ephemeral lake. Newsweek found the photo. In that particular case, I don't even believe they
video still showing the.
Again, the photographer said, look, this is
exact tweet from Barry Sanders.
You're using it to illustrate what
that brain. And
it's my work, and that's copyright infringement. So the Newsweek came back and they said similar. They said we have a license as to this by virtue of the embedding license that you have granted as the photographer to Instagram. And secondly, it's a fair use. We're
in the post
and it's permissible and we're allowed to do that. So the court in McGuckin said for the purposes of summary judgment motion to dismiss, actually. And so it was motion to dismiss. And for the purposes of motion to dismiss, we don't clearly see that it was intended that you were supposed to be a beneficiary of this license. And so we got to take a look. We got to examine that. So we're not going to allow that. And then on the basis of fair use, they said, look, you know,
Instax is an instant film variation.
It's certainly not on a motion to dismiss.
And there is no
board with the trial and with the proceedings. Segue back to Sinclair. Sinclair files a motion for reconsideration and says, look, you know, you've got a Southern District of New York case, almost the same factual pattern. And there was no
starting to rise in popularity among
the claims based on basically the same claims that the defendants had raised. And so on the motion for reconsideration, the court agreed with the plaintiff. And so that case is
people who want to create instant memories
is still active and is still live. So you have now this issue of, okay, is embedding okay or is it not? You know, then
I think Polaroid picture
as well. We don't actually possess.
If you look at page 7, I put some of the different
these particular photographs. We just embedded it. If you click on the embedded photographs, it takes you to the photographer.
Very similar in concept.
And so that's all fine under perfect 10. At the same time, you have the courts expressing some significant skepticism, as you've seen.
Really in what I'm going to refer to as on my desk at home, I have two.
Permissible. Is that really what was allowed with perfect 10? Is that what we should really allow?
Options.
Real uncertainty as to all of that, and in part also, you know, in a lot of real uncertainty to it. So questions with Perfect 10, and then also, you know, you have a question about Perfect 10 being really a fair use case. That's what it was. It wasn't about, you know, was something temporary? Was it
5-7, an embed action
was it a fair use? So with that, Shalene, you want to discuss a little bit about the fair use defense?
Yeah, so fair use is very common. We were doing like just before the pandemic got in. Actually, we never really explained what happened with Google's cached images that they stored themselves. And what the court found there was that those were fair uses. So on slide 29, we have the statutory framework for the fair use to kind of hit, and we were allowed to still see people again, Section 107. And there's four factors that have been approved by Congress to basically discuss or how to analyze if whether or not a otherwise infringing use would be. So what they've done, fair one. And the first factor would be the purpose and character of the use. The second factor, the article. This is an article about it. Third is the amount of substantiality of the portion used. And four is the effect on the marketplace. And what the courts have done is explain, well, what do these factors actually mean? How do we evaluate these to see whether or not these factors, whether or not a use is not fair and should, and liability should follow. So explaining the factors in the abstract as a gallery. So purpose and character of the use. This first factor is focused on whether the use merely supersedes the object of the original. If you were to click any of those pictures, courts regularly simplify these factors asking, is it transformative? Does it have some other use than the one that the in that gallery? It would take you to the specific. Given the state of embedding and what we're seeing it used for, and to trends that we've seen, embedding is usually used when someone wants to comment substantively, specific Instagram posts where you can see the comments to embed or substantively on what the embedded content is about, not necessarily using what the embedded content was as a substitute for, or using the new content as a substitute for what postponed or. And the second factor is the nature of the copyrighted work. And that doesn't make too much sense on its face. And what the courts have done is decide, well, is this even changed? Whether or not this document or this work is something that is factual or creative, or is it something when the date of the national championship is no unpublished? The reason for this is that we want to know whether or not the work is factual so that we know how much latitude it's going to be leading up to the college football championship. More protections in a factual work because we want to disseminate those facts to the public. And then an unpublished work is going to be given more deference for, or less deference for fair use than something that is published. Now, the idea being that published works, the author or original copyright owner has already decided to disseminate something into the world. In an unpublished work, that person has made a conscious or from InStax's page their vision to be published, and in some cases choose not to publish it at all. The seminal case on that is Harper and Row Publishers, which was actually about President Ford's memoirs. He actually contracted with Harper and Row to publish his memoirs after they were written. Time Magazine licensed the memoirs to prepare an article about the pardon of President Nixon. And just before the article published national championship in 2015, the memoir and published before the Time article published. And because the memoirs themselves, the original work, had never been published, the court found, well, the nation could be your public page, a famous athlete, but the memoirs could have never been published at all, but they chose to publish a Time magazine. And because they were somewhat ESPN comments on Carl Jones's memoirs, but they're factual because they were kind of history page, the function actually weighs in favor of finding something to be infringing rather than a fair use. But we typically don't see a lot of weight. Reality is pretty seamless. The difference is it's transformative or serves another purpose in the original work. The third and fourth factors, outlined on page 31, also do a good amount of work and are often looked at independently. The third factor is hard to resolve just in certain cases. So another important case is Solid Oak Sketches, the 2K games. So what the third factor asks is, did I use more than the amount and substantiality of portion of use of the copyrighted work as related to the other one? So the question again is, did I use more than I need to? In Solid Oak Sketches, the 2K games, the issue was there was a tattoo artist who had done multiple tattoos for multiple NBA players. And in the NBA 2K games, the studio to make the character models as realistic as possible. Video games, as in general, trying to get more and more realistic. And that included reproducing the tattoos. So to the court, when evaluating the fair use defense, they asked, well, did you take seeing is not two layers of that is, well, no. In the case of a tattoo, you know, these character models are going to have their full arms and legs and limbs, and if you're going to want to reproduce characters as much as possible, you need the whole tattoo. And embedding, you know, if you're already embedding but just one, Cardinal will generate the entire embedded content, then you're going to need the entire content that you embedded. You're going to need the entire post or tweet or image. And since Hootsuite has actually saved that to use on the potential market or value for the copyrighted work, we can again turn to solid old sketches and we can think, okay, well, does a tattoo in a video game change the value of the artist's copyright in 6, where you can see Google actually gives it. The artist's value in the tattoo copyright in Hootsuite, and then ESPN is embedded tattoos, where I want someone to come get this tattoo and they can only get it from me. Well, that's not going to really make that whole image. Someone who wants a video game that realistically depicts NBA players is not going to change their mind on wanting a tattoo because of its existence in a game. And that's a way that we should be looking at embedding. Just putting that content in another website, will that whole image change someone's mind about whether or not they would purchase it? If that answer is yes, well, then that factor is going to weigh in favor of it is embedded as if it's one thing. No, when that factor is going to weigh in favor of fair use. So if we turn to slide 32, we can see how fair use was used in Bracket 10. And factor one, was it used transformative? Well, Google's use of a thumbnail to show search results is highly transformative. So it's important to have functionality and add a market for these thumbnail size images. Back in the early 2000s, people were still using flip phones, and people who wanted those kinds of images on their phone could have purchased them for Bracket 10 of the thumbnail size. But Google's use wasn't just something to show that picture, it was a pointer. Google's use for thumbnails, as the court described it, transformed the image into a pointer directing a user to the source of the information. When you click that thumbnail, you were given the choice to go to where their full image was hosted. The fact that that image wasn't hosted by Perfect 10 and was stolen by somebody else wasn't necessarily Google's fault. So they say that the significantly transformative nature of Google's search engine outweighs Google's superseding commercial uses of thumbnails, even though so the court acknowledged that Google was a for-profit company that used advertising and using this image search as another way to generate revenue, found that a search engine is transformative compared to the picture in its original state or another copy. The nature of the copyrighted work was another fact that they have Google. While they were creative, Perfect 10's images were already previously published, unlike those memoirs. Once it's exploited, it's commercially valuable right of first publication. Perfect 10 is no longer entitled to enhanced functions. The amount and substantiality of portion used was neutral. Google used the entire image, but that was reasonable for the purpose of the search engine to allow you embed content. You're forcing the user whether or not to pursue more information from the originating website. The purpose of the thumbnail was to show someone, well, if you want more, go to where you can actually find it, not Google's thumbnail version. And the effect on the market was neutral. Google's thumbnail hypothetically competed with Perfect 10 set embedded there. You were looking at cell phone size images. But as most surgeons know, that they have to prove that harm, and Perfect 10 at that time hadn't given enough evidence to show that Google's thumbnail searches were somehow replacing Perfect 10's market in or share of that market for thumbnail images. So how do we apply that to these new kind of newish cases where embedding is mostly Instagram or the case that Mike was talking about with the current developments? If we go to slide 33 and 34, we're going to see more fair use cases where there are articles that are substantively commenting on someone's choice to embed. The first is Wall Street Town Square Media case. If you want to look at something in a hyper, a paparazzo took a picture of Cardi B outside of the Tom Ford fashion show at the same time Cardi B was partnering with Tom Link. You can't actually see what she sold out immediately. And the defendants in that case, I think it was XXL Magazine, they posted an article commenting on the Instagram post. They used Cardi B's post herself, Tom Ford's post, and another one to show the success and just comment on the fact that Instagram was being used for these. So in this case, we're looking at information. The article commented on Cardi B's post itself as well, and the court found that was fair use, and we'll get into the reasons in another case in a second, but I want to highlight first the second case is Bozen v. United States Publishing. Your computer, you can look, defendant was a newspaper or an article that wanted to comment substantively on the use of Instagram to your hyperlink. You can look at the hyperlink. Ellen Wesniacki, a famous tennis player, announced her retirement. Carolyn Wozniacki was very popular in the mid-2010s, and she's been playing since professionally since she was 15. So what this publisher wanted to do was focus on copyright. Instagram, of all places, not a press conference or something to announce her retirement. Well, the owner of the picture sued because he said, well, that's my picture of her as her, during her professional debut. And even though she used a low-resolution copy of this picture, well, this is my... I've gotten some questions about rights reason to sell it and license it. And I'm in the business of licensing those pictures, so this is infringement. Again, here, the court granted a motion dismissed for failure to state a claim because of fair use offense. So why were they fair use? Well, the answer to that first question is, were they transformative? The answer is yes. The original pictures served a purpose of identifying a celebrity or taking a picture of a celebrity. But the second uses were not really used to identify the subject of the articles, but rather to comment on a specific post. So these are critiques of a post or prose, a blatant video hosted entirely on using generic images of that celebrity to show that person, which just happened to be owned by the respective plaintiffs. Second, the nature of both works were already published, and they were highly factual photographs. So the subject of the photographs is a person, and the creative elements are going to be lens choice, magnification, lighting, and those other choices. But those choices don't significantly weigh in favor of fair use, especially when courts in general don't put a lot of weight on the second factor to go. But the amount of the posts used the amount of the pictures used in the publications. Of course, all the topic we can do right now and the entire pictures that were taken. But the reason for that was, well, it wasn't more than they needed. If you're going to comment about a post on Instagram, there is a problem with the stream quality. Comment on that post without showing the entire thing. And lastly, the effect on the market favored the defendants. In both cases, the courts found that, well, the Instagram posts aren't substitutes for the original without them ever hosting it. The Instagram post was low resolution, and the only way to get the high resolution version was to go through the photographer himself. In the same way, so the article or the embed for the original, there's no effect on the market of someone using those posts to comment substantively on the use of social media or how social media has affected a certain event. So the important thing to note with fair use is that it's one of the defenses that's going to be widely criticized and widely available for the end user to receive. The website's embedded, the YouTube. Well, the server test isn't as golden as you thought they would be, but there's still an important value that we can place on embedding content, especially in a journalism content video, a random page that has something embedded from Instagram, social media in a way that's powerful and engaging. But we're still not quite sure what are the legal defenses that we have outside of going to see that post, whether or not that perfect 10 throws that into question. So with that, I think it's a good time to talk about practical recommendations and wrap up.
Thanks, Jalene. I appreciate it. Well, I think, having thought about this, we both are of accord that we need to go back to the ancient bard, which then ties into
to create a hyperlink. And the important thing here is to kind of
the question of embedding, certainly the question of borrowing. And as Shakespeare wrote, neither a borrower nor a lender be, for all loan doth loses both itself and a friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. And the answer to that is, of course, wait, what? But I think in terms of giving some practical thoughts and
we have a general idea of what embedding is.
Both if you are representing a content provider or a content user, some thoughts with regard to that. Certainly, as Shalene said, the answer of, oh, it's okay under Perfect 10 is really in all likelihood not going to work anymore. So then what you're going to have, the question of whether it is a link or embedded or whether, it exists on servers and the server test and all those things, that has really been called into question. I think courts are really going to be back and forth as to that being a defense. And so then you're really left with fair use. And the difficulty, as everyone appreciates with fair use, is it is unbelievably intensely factual. And that's the difficulty with it. And
between taking a picture and
You're not going to get it. It would be very difficult. And as the cases in the Southern District of New York showed, it's really tough to get out on either a motion to dismiss or some
that we 100%
defense. It just they're hard. And so for the moment, that's what you're really left with, in terms
I created a copy of this on the WL.
If you were representing a company, they have social media pages, there is a commentary or there's a photo or a celebrity that uses
video still showing the
product. You got to really, really question about do you allow an embedding on that?
Embedding beyond the social media context
is a poor substitute, but do you go with linking? And is that what you do and say, hey, here's, great.
And beyond just simply
this. Heard this on the street. And do you go with that, with the linking rather than the embedding? Because the question is, what are you really using that for? If it's on a company social media post, is that commercial use? And under the Two Live Crew case, commercial use isn't fatal to a fair use defense, but it weighs against it.
Calculated some of those reasons.
Commenting and criticizing, a use in that particular case, or is it just really using it for some additional publicity? So I think, for companies advising on this, you just really have to consider when you are going to be embedding and allowing embedding. Or saying, hey, we really feel good about the fair use defense in this particular case. If you are going to go down with the fair use, is it the risk worth the reward? Is that really by using the actual photograph, is that really going to benefit you or just use the link? Is that something that you're going to consider? Because there are a lot of photographers right now who have a lot of lawyers who are going
on to that tweet. So from a journalist,
in the cases we've listed here, just a few of the handful of many cases where companies, celebrity
perspective, we're going to see
great infringement.
Local hosts on that third-party website
as to this, but I think is folks realize social media exists in light years and getting licenses exists in dog years. It just they are it takes forever to get it. You have negotiated back and forth. You have terms as to all of that. So a license, if you're looking for absolute certainty, a license is a way to go, but as a practical matter, is that really going to be something that you're going to be able to do? On if you're representing content owners, photographers, right now,
someone's use of embedding content,
other social media platforms still have
hyperlinking
that your client is consenting to the use of that work. Now, as Shalene read earlier, there are various sites that are walking that
another
look. If you are a user, so that if you are, company XYZ and you have your, and you're using content on Instagram, well, you need to make sure.
But simply the difference.
The arguments that were raised in the Southern District of New York case is about, well, we are, under the umbrella.
Companies get a lot of feedback through.
Instagram is walking that back and saying, we're not sure about that, as that, because the question is Instagram doesn't want to be liable for contributory infringement. Are they setting up a platform where they're contributorily liable for this? So, if you're a photographer, you have a question that, okay, you can, post, your work on there and you can elect not to, allow embedding of it. But then the question is, if you keep it.
So if we look at,
are you going to get the same amount of publicity? Are you going to get the same amount of attention? Are you going to show up as high on Google search engine results? And the answer to that probably is no, that you are making a decision that you're going to protect your works and unauthorized use of your works, but you are potentially also restricting, the spread and the fame and notoriety of your work. So if you're representing photographers, you know, one of the options may be to say, look, put a watermark on it so that it really becomes, if you're Newsweek, are you really going to use a photograph of a lake that has a watermark with a
very commonly and they get positive.
Or, you know, at that point, are you going to reach out to the photographer and you're going to need to get a license, you know, for that. So there's some maybe perhaps some technological solutions that you can use if you're representing content owners that will help with this. So
that feedback with some
what's going to happen with this, you know, the suspicion on this.
So if we look at this example from
well, or I think you're going to end up with needing a solution to this because fair use and licensing is just too clumsy and cumbersome.
ESPN article. This is an article about
in with the way
in your web,
the internet and social media these days, and there has to be a quicker solution in terms of it. And so ultimately,
and a subsequent apology by
the permission that's going to be granted for a use going to be some sort of non-commercial use. Is it for use of individual
experience with the product?
Not an end-all be-all because there's
Nick Saban's daughter
been spent over whether something is in fact a
And another reason is
there going to be some sort of a solution of, look, you are granting a license as to this. And that is, you know, going to give people assurance that they can, if I have my own personal, Instagram feed that I'm going to be able to embed on that. If I'm a company, what's the extent that I'm going to be allowed to do that? But is that really extend to uses like Mashable and Newsweek, which are really articles, you know, where traditionally they have paid for photographs of those nature. So does it extend to that? So I think this is all TBD right now, but the bottom line of
content and by not
careful, because there is definitely the potential for a lawsuit if you use someone else's work, even if it's embedded.
Seeing those images or having to rehost.
Yeah, just one quick one. I think the way that the social media outlets are going to start addressing this is they're going to start saying, one, embed at your own risk. I think that's going to, Instagram started that off. And I think the second one is going to be, you're going to start allowing users to control what's embedded and what's not through privacy settings. And therefore, that's going to hopefully bring changes on the one hand, to know that if they want to use social media to promote themselves, well, that's, you know, that's the last reproduction that they're going to be giving outside of, you know, the social media platform's license that you're going to give through their agreements. But also it's going to protect someone else who wants to embed from being functionally stopped from doing it via a user's privacy settings. That's what I think is going to happen, but it's going to be a while for any that really shakes out.
Excellent. Well, good. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Shalene, thank you. It's real been a pleasure and a joy to be able to give this presentation. We thank everyone who has listened.
If anyone's a football
fan and given you some thoughts and perhaps some ideas, I would encourage if anyone has any further questions, they can either be submitted through this process or if you look on the Troutman.
Instead of having
is available there, and we certainly would be happy to respond to any further questions with regard to the issue. So with that, I think we're going to go ahead and sign off. Again, thanks, everyone.
The third stream backup from
and hope everyone stay safe and well and moves forward. So thanks very much.
Thanks, everyone.